And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. Way back in episode 4 of the podcast, I talked to Andrew Panton about the Lancaster bomber. Andrew, if you recall, is the pilot of the Lancaster Just Jane here in the UK. Whilst chatting, the role of the flight engineer came up. I had no clue what they actually did. I wasn't aware that they worked in tandem with the pilot to fly the plane. Ever since, I've been on the lookout for someone to talk to about the role. If you do a search in Amazon, you'll discover how overlooked they seem to have been in the historiography. So joining me today is Colin Pateman. Colin specialises in writing about the RAF. Earlier this year, he released his latest book, Fuel, Fire and Fear, The RAF Flight Engineers at War. But before we get to that, I'd like to say a big hello to all new loyal listeners of the show who recently signed up as patrons. You guys really do help keep the show going. I have a copy of David Fletcher's British Battle Tanks to give away to one of you, and I'll do the draw in the next day or so and let the lucky winner know. So if you're not already a patron of the podcast, it's very simple. Head over to patreon.com/WW2podcast, where you can commit to contributing a dollar or so each month to help me make the podcast. Once you've joined the gang, you'll have access to the extras, usually off-topic chat, that's never made it into the podcast. So that's patreon.com/WW2podcast. Colin, thanks for joining me. I wonder if we should start by looking back at the end of World War One. The RAF was only recently formed. Flight was still relatively new. Was there a scheme in place to train engineering personnel? Indeed, were they even flying on the planes?
There clearly was a need for the mechanical aspects of engineering and engines to be cared for, and that was all ground-based. But by an evolution process of we need to test that, these men quite often went up in the larger aircraft themselves, and they would be regarded as ground crew, but actually ground crew who just continued their duty in the air. So they were never given any status of air crew, but that's how it sort of evolved.
Did the RAF a training scheme for ground crew? I mean, they did start that apprentice scheme at Cranwell, didn't they? After the war,
they did, but it was always based upon the need to have an engineering aspect of ensuring that the engines were capable and working. There wasn't a pre-planned structure at that time to say, we will need this body of people and they need this, that and the other. They evolved from the point of view of necessity as opposed to concept or design. And that evolution just drew people from being engineers or airframe people or on the ground who just were drawn up into the air. So that was the concept. And obviously we know that grew from that point onwards.
It's a funny idea that these fitters and mechanics are for such a long time were just seen as being, as I say, ground crew and not necessarily air crew. Presumably then, so the planes get bigger. The first planes were the seaplanes. Was that position on board seen as being an engineer? What was the early need for an engineer, a mechanic or whatever it was, what was that role anticipated to be?
Well, you're quite right. As the airframes grew in size, and obviously they were also growing in complexity. There was the desirability, I think, from the flight crew to have somebody with them that could actually be accountable to mind the engine. And in actual fact, they were known as engine minders. So they were still ground crew, but they were flying as an engine minder. They weren't obviously reimbursed financially as being air crew. They were still, it mattered not whether they were working in a hangar or actually in the air in the larger aircraft. And that is the roots of how it progressed further. But at that time, I don't think anybody had a vision to say, this is the way forward, and we will actually need to be robust and think about getting more people qualified and create an establishment. That was far from mind, really. It was the fact that these aircraft were flying longer distances, that the aircraft engine might break down while on such a longer flight, and therefore have somebody on board that maybe can deal with that situation. That really was all that was being catered for.
On these flying boats, what was the engine minder's duties?
I cannot be specific because, of course, most of my work, I really like to go to grassroots and speak to the veterans. That's where most of my archives come from. So we're at an era where that's impossible. Understanding is that they were just looked as an experienced engineer that was on the aircraft, and he was there to deal with any unintended occurrences that sort of developed as and when and if during the flight. That I think it's really as basic as that.
Presumably they chose flight mechanics and the engine fitters themselves for these roles for these early roles, were they?
Oh, yes. I think I'm of the opinion that these people that were dedicated and cherished the sort of mechanical aspects of the engines were passionate about them to such an extent that any opportunity to sort of see it in action, as it were, even though it's not action but actually in the longevity of flight, that they would relish it. And I don't think there was an issue in relation to getting the staffing of these engine minders at all.
Well, by the end of the 30s, there's the technical training school in Wales, isn't it, producing these specific RAF engineers. So the pool of people to choose from must have been quite skillful by then.
Yes, I think by that time we've got very banded areas of qualification, because obviously you've got the engine, the engineers, the mechanics, and then you've got the airframe. People that were responsible for the airframe. So this was a route towards the more dedicated roles that eventually came into being.
So they already have people flying in planes. Sort of, is it semi ad hoc, this sort of basis of flight mechanic? I mean, if you put mechanic on a plane, even after the war started, and we haven't quite got the role formalised of the flight engineer. Is it on an ad hoc basis, or did they just say, right, Tommy Atkins, you're flying today? Or was there do we have a halfway house role created by the RAF? Maybe that's a way of putting it.
I don't think I can truthfully answer that, because I don't really know. All I get the distinct impression is that there certainly wasn't any issue in getting anyone to voluntarily fly with the crew on their aircraft, which they repaired and looked after. It wasn't formalised. It was a fairly informal arrangement, and that informality is explained very much from the point of view that they were definitely not regarded as aircrew.
It's a very ad hoc way of going to war, sort of, rather than being the ultra slick machine that we might get later. It's very much us making it up as we go along.
When we start about, you know, getting towards the end of the interwar period and the actual Second World War, the objectives of the RAF at that time weren't focused on in any respect of the subject we're talking about. They were completely focused upon, have we got enough of the light bomber aircraft which we were producing at that time, and have we got enough of the crew to fly them, and that did not include flight engineers. So it never really became a forefront point of interest until the war progressed towards the building of the heavier bombers.
Yeah, and I got that impression. But one funny thing that had occurred to me, and I forgot to get the date out, that they program for the heavy bombers, which you know, the Manchester and the were going to the Lancaster, it did start before the war broke out. So that the ministry must have been aware that presumably in that specification for those heavy bombers, such a role was needed. Yet it takes them quite a long time to get round to formalising that role, which is, when was the role formalised? I didn't make a note.
Really, we need to talk about the Stirling, because the Stirling was the first large heavy bomber that was actually constructed and built with what I would term as a flight engineer station. So in other words, it was an aircraft that was conceived and built knowing that there would be somebody that would be accountable for that role in the aircraft. But that said, at that time, there was no flight engineer in being as such. You're quite right in your observations. It does seem rather remiss that they were conceptually building and constructing and eventually did construct a large heavy bomber, but in actual fact didn't actually have a formal flight engineer in being to actually man the position which they presumably knew very well would require manning. Now that may be that they were thinking that maybe there were some dual role possibilities here or other options, but that's probably a question that nobody can answer, really. It is rather puzzling, and it's, when I did the book, it was something that I really tried to bottom out, but never really could, because it's not documented as such. The creation of the aircraft is, but the position of flight engineer itself is not something which was documented in any detail to say that, oh, when we built this aircraft, we will actually need a flight engineer as part of the crew. That just seemed to evolve and happen.
Is it the Stirling that came out with that was anticipated? They initially had the mechanic air gunner position. Is that what they thought would be on the Stirling?
Well, I like to really simplify this on the basis of a light bomber was a two-engined aircraft, and a two-engined aircraft was deemed unnecessary to have anyone that actually was responsible for engine minding or flight engineer characteristic or duties. It wasn't until the aircraft came along with four engines that the complexity of managing that number of engines and the quantities of fuel required to dissipate to all of those four engines and the general complexity of a larger aircraft with four engines, that in essence was why we've ended up with the flight engineer post, because it was complicated and those duties were way and above and beyond the capability of what the pilot was also doing. And the navigator also had duties which were specific enough that they weren't able to be extrapolated from to do this other valuable requirement within the crew.
After reading the accounts, it seems wildly optimistic that in crisis points of when you're over Germany and you've got fighters coming in, your flight engineer is key at monitoring everything. The last thing you want to be doing is leaving his position to try and operate a machine gun to attack incoming aircraft as well. It seems, wildly optimistic idea.
The RAF always had the ambition to dual train members of a heavy bomber crew to do another task. Not to the level that the dedicated officer or non-commissioned officer was in post for, but when a crew member was injured or lost their life at their post, that there would be some basic elements of training that other crewmen could fill that slot for. In other words, it was a safety measure to try to ensure that the aircraft got back if at all possible.
the rules formalised in 42. So where do they suddenly produce flight engineers from? Where's the cadre of men coming from to fill this role?
When the recognition of the need for staff was really taken on board, I think the first thought was, well, we've got a very good, strong ground base of people with an engineering background. We will make it available for them to volunteer to be flight crew. They can transfer their skills from the ground, and we already have them skilled to such a level. Their additional training would probably be minimal, and then we will have a pool of people that will just be able to move across into an aircrew status. That was the first concept of making this situation work.
That's the first swath of people. Then you've got to fill it. So presumably they had a scheme set up. Now, these ground crews, many of them have been trained for, well, they've gone through boy apprenticeships, they've gone through other training schemes. They themselves were highly skilled people. The rate Bomber Command was going through people, they must have had to produce, after that first wave, have to produce them. Did they have a scheme in place pretty quickly that could, I don't know, rush men through? Can you rush men through on such a complicated job?
I got the impression when researching the subject that the flow was sort of like a little bit, this is what we'll do, and then it was, we haven't quite resolved this issue, so we need to do something else. And then they then started to recruit in different means, but there was still at that time not the capability for direct recruitment from outside of the RAF. And by that, what I mean is that there was still this concept that you had to have a lot of training, a lot of background experience, a lot of ability to be able to fulfill these roles. Whereas in effect, they were a little bit short-sighted initially, because the country had a lot of engineers, a lot of people with engineering background that were either in a reserved occupation, which prevented them from serving at that time, or they were possibly just on the age of being able to serve. But actually, these people could themselves voluntarily bring quite a lot of experience with them straight away, and that eventually led to the direct recruitment of flight engineers, and that did actually prove to be quite successful. It may explain why, when you start looking at some of the casualties, that after their initial training, that there are quite a lot of flight engineers that lost their lives at early ages, and they will have been the young people that immediately volunteered from, you know, the garage workshop and the engineering background that they had. It's another example of how the need required flexibility from the approach of, we do need dedicated people with a very good understanding, because a flight engineer was not just responsible for ensuring the flow of oil and fuel. And basically, in the air, when something mechanically went wrong, the entire crew would look to the flight engineer to get them home. You know, that was a pretty awesome responsibility, really.
They're minding the fuel tanks. Presumably, they're switching the fuel between tanks as and when necessary on these, you know, huge, long bomber missions. How much could they do in the air if they had a problem?
They had to be innovative. They had to be able to think on their feet and deal with so many uncomplicated issues that had significant ramifications. So, you know, it may be that the pilot, for instance, hadn't heard from the rear gunner, and he would send the flight engineer back, and the engineer would find that he was suffering from oxygen failure, and he would then try to resolve that. It would be when they suffered from a flak, which was non-fatal but caused a problem in flying the aircraft, then there was one person that was looked at to see if it was capable of being rectified, and that was the flight engineer. And with the most basic of tools and the most arduous situations, these people did some remarkable things in not mending the aircraft, but just make do and mend and try to get the crew home safe. And they did it on many, many occasions with remarkable bravery as well.
What surprised me about this sort of where they had to, were expected to sort of band-aid almost anything, they must have known those aircraft literally to a nuts and bolts level to be able to fix some of these very peculiar problems that might arise.
The main training establishment in this country, St Athens, there was quite a progressive mindset in relation to teaching the flight engineers in training. There would be dioramas, I suppose we would call them these days, of fluid systems. Most of the fluid systems, the pneumatic systems in the aircraft, they were color-coded, and it was quite arduous to try to remember it. But the value in knowing where one pipe went and what it did was quite often the reason why things could be mended the way they were. The Stirling was very heavily reliant on electrical components and the electrical engineering, and likewise they would be expected to know the wirings and the workings of where the motor feeds were and which motor fed what and so on and so forth, so they could go direct to a problem and try and deal with it straight away.
In training, were they aircraft specific? So would they do a certain amount of basic training and then go, okay, right, you guys are going to be on Stirlings, and then from that point in they just looked at Stirlings or Lancasters or Halifaxes? Or
there was a forward thinking position where with their training that their training would lean towards the specific heavy bomber, so the Stirling, the Halifax, the Lancaster or the Coastal Command aircraft. But it wasn't guaranteed. So as much as anything, they ended up getting a feeling that I'm going to be on Halifaxes because I'm doing, you know, most of my work on Halifaxes. But there was a cross flow over all of it, and there was certainly no guarantee that was the case. But it, in concept, I think it was a good idea. But in execution, it never really had a good, solid base to say that it worked very well. I think what really did work well was these people had enough experience training-wise over all of the airframes that their competency would grow once they became operational.
Over time. So the RAF, when they form crews, have this ad hoc way of seemingly sticking men in a hangar and saying, get on with it, form a crew. Were the flight engineers part of the same process?
What you've mentioned there is has sort of grown into being as an accepted medium that is what happened. Indeed, it did happen that way. Not without exception, it would happen differently either. But yes, the flight engineer joined the crew at a time where, in a lot of cases, they had already sort of semi-formed, because I think I'm correct in saying that he was one of the last crew members to actually sort of join forth with a complete crew. They never actually experienced, unless it was they had exceptional opportunities to do otherwise, their training was all ground-based, so they actually became qualified as a flight engineer before they actually even took off the ground in a heavy bomber. It's quite remarkable, really. Their transition was quite significant from one to the other, whereas obviously a pilot's gone through a very long training program and obviously necessitates a lot of airtime. Air gunners were given a lot of airtime as well, but flight engineers were trained to the level, and then they joined an operational crew.
It seems quite remarkable that they don't get to necessarily fly about in as part of their training and work in sort of confined spaces, you know, in turbulence and mock flak and things.
Their learning curve, sort of operationally, was probably one of the sharpest.
It's the heavy conversion units is where the crews all train together. So, as you say, presumably they all it was a steep learning curve for them when they get to these heavy conversion. I'm not sure why were they called heavy conversion units, these training units, because presumably if all these guys, some of these guys probably only flew heavies.
Obviously, there was a main swing within Bomber Command from the light bombers to the heavy bombers, and you would quite often have a crew that had done a tour or best part of a tour in a Wellington, a two-engine Wellington, and they would then convert onto the four-engined aircraft. So those crews will have never flown with a flight engineer. So the heavy conversion unit is exactly what it says, heavy relating to the heavy aircraft, and they're converted to fly onto it. And with that, they have the additional member of the crew, which they never had before. So in those circumstances, you've got a newly trained flight engineer joining an old sort crew that sort of have operational experience. And that must have been quite difficult, because I get the impression these men were quite tightly bonded, and that flight engineer's got to integrate himself. But I'm sure they acknowledge the fact that they're now in a very different aircraft, and this flight engineer has a big area of responsibility for their safety. So no doubt that was very much respected, and that's why probably it worked as well as it did.
I wondered what it must have been like for some of these pilots who'd been flown other things, and they're suddenly put on a larger plane, and some of their duties are removed from them with a flight engineer. And that must have been quite a peculiar thing for them, not to just to do it all themselves.
Yes, and of course, the RAF was very rank structured, you know, the officers and the NCOs. And of course, in the early days, all of the flight engineers were all NCOs. They were all sergeants, flight sergeants. You know, there were no officers, flight engineers, because it was a new service, a new post. Things were stacked up against them a little bit, but clearly from what you can find out talking to the veterans and the research, that the fact that they knew this was a very large aircraft, very much more complicated, and actually I think probably there would have been a little bit of consolation to know that there is actually somebody here who's just responsible for keeping this old lady in the air and ensuring that the fuel and the oil and all the other things that are required to make it get there and back, that's all he's doing.
Did they have ground duties? I mean, were they issued a specific plane and said, okay, here you go, and did they sort of maintain that plane, as it were, oversee it all, or is that not how they worked? They were literally just got what they were given on each mission.
The operational orders for every operation obviously dictated the crews and dictated the aircraft that were going to be flying, because of servicing schedules and other damage that may be repaired. There was no guarantee that any crew would maintain allegiance to one aircraft. But that said, it's fairly obvious that a lot of crews, out of choice, would always have a preference airframe. I suppose they would all have their own little characteristics, and you probably had a little bit of luck in there that was a good trip, so I'd like to go in her again. But no, it was very unusual for a crew to have continuity with a particular aircraft.
Something I've not touched on, but I should have possibly asked earlier. Within the aircraft themselves, they're not a co-pilot. They're not sat next to the pilot. I don't think. I mean, where is their position?
Well, the concept with the flight engineer was that he was part of the Halifax and the Lancaster in particular. They were part of the cockpit crew as such. There was a flexible seating arrangement in the Lancaster whereby a seat was able to be put up next to the pilot. It actually sort of sat over the entrance point for where the bomb aimer would crawl underneath and go to the front area. And that actually allowed the flight engineer to sit alongside the pilot and assist with the duties of the landing gear and takeoff and landing procedures. He also was able to view backwards the controls for the fuel and other controls, and they were ergonomically designed with some sort of color-coded system which allowed it to be done not from a distance, but certainly in low light and adverse conditions it assisted the flight engineer. So yes, the flight engineer was part of the reassurance from the crew point that he was the first point of reference for the pilot. He would never have actually undergone official flying duties, but he could take over and help the pilot, and obviously in the most adverse conditions whereby the pilot was unable to fly the aircraft, then he would be the natural choice to get the aircraft home.
Is there a desk position somehow by the behind the pilot, presumably near the wireless operator? Usually, most of these planes,
you would have the pilot in the, if you looking at the aircraft back to the front, the pilot sitting on the left hand side, and the flight engineer would have this accessory seat on the right hand side. If he chose not to sit in it, because apparently it wasn't the most comfortable of things to sit in for long periods of time, then he would be almost alongside the navigator's table, immediately behind him, able to view head-on the control panel that sits on the side of the aircraft. And you could still obviously reach the cockpit area as well, because they're in very, very close proximity.
The funny thing about these aircraft is you see them and they're huge, and then you go in, is it the Imperial War Museum that used to have, is it the front of a Lancaster? And you got in it and it is remarkably confined once you're in it.
Yeah, I mean, the design concept from the Ministry of Aircraft Production and the Air Ministry and the bodies that sort of saw the overseeing of the aircraft's evolvement were aware that there was a need for these aircrew to be able to move around from position safely. But that said, the main spar, which connects the two wings together, basically, is a very significant piece of engineering, and it restricts the ability to move quite significantly. And once you go over it from the fuselage, you're immediately met with the wireless operator's position, and then you're immediately met with the navigator's table, and then you're then immediately on top of the flight engineer panel and into the cockpit. So it's a massive aircraft, but once you get over that main spar, everything really concertinas up, and it is quite confined, and it's very difficult now to appreciate if you look at that, what it was like in the darkness, wearing a thick Irving jacket, and it is quite awesome. It really is.
I have to say, I have an Irving jacket, and they're fantastically warm that it is. It is surprisingly bulky to try and work in. You wouldn't necessarily choose to drive your car in one.
No, not at all. But of course, over 10,000 feet, they are working off oxygen, and that in itself is a limiting factor as well. So you put all those things together, and you do have to step back and look and think, goodness me, that really was quite something to do. And of course, you have to remember that if the flight engineer was required to leave that station to go and deal with an issue elsewhere in the aircraft, then he had to do so by carrying his transportable oxygen supply. He's got to carry that. He's got to carry some tools. And I'm just in awe, really, that some of the circumstances of what they did in such perilous situations.
Well, I was just thinking of fire. So if you have a fire breakout, and presumably what they could do is limited. But if you're, again, you've got to pick your oxygen bottle up, get out of your chair. Presumably there's an extinguisher to hand that you somehow have to wield round the plane. Everything you're carrying is an obstacle within itself before you've even fought the fire.
Yes. The most predominant fire issue that they were dealing with were obviously engine fires, either through mechanical failures or through enemy anti-aircraft damage, but each engine was fitted with its own system to deal with a fire, which was able to be operated by the flight engineer or the pilot. These were very, very important things because each engine also provided different facilities of operation to the turrets or other operations within the heavy bomber. So losing an engine in itself is okay because they can still fly easily on three, but it would have created some limitations regardless. And then, of course, your flight engineer is actively responsible for feathering the engine, for ensuring that maybe the propeller can still turn and not create too much disturbance to the airflow. And, you know, these fires sometimes re-erupted and they were significant. And, of course, the Battle of Britain Memorial flight, Lancaster, which is one of the country's treasures, you know, that experienced an engine fire, I think, 2011. And the flight engineer there was Mark Fellows. And that flight sergeant experienced quite uniquely in a modern era exactly what did happen so many times over enemy territory.
So you use the phrase there, feathering the propeller. Can you explain that? Because it's an expression I'm sure many people have heard, but what we're quite unsure what it actually means.
Well, a propeller clearly is controlled from the point of view that it has a bearing which allows it to cut into the air at a different angle, and that is used to pull as much air across it, obviously on takeoff, as possible to get as much leverage from that engine to pull it through the air. Once the bomber's in the air, then the pilot would synchronise all the propellers to turn so that you've got the sweetest and the less disturbance going on. And they could do that simply by almost just looking from their position, and they could tell by the rotation of the propellers that everything was synchronised. And the feathering in relation to when an engine was not working or was malfunctioning or after a fire would be to turn the propeller so that it created the least obstruction into the air, so that it would still turn through the motions of the air passing over it, but it would turn with the least velocity. It's very technical, but that was my understanding of it, and that's where you quite often get accounts where an engine they've got trouble with controlling that situation, and you can end up with a bearings and components of where the propeller is joining the shaft in the engine actually breaking down, and the actual propellers detaching themselves and causing other catastrophic damage to an aircraft.
Yeah, it's one of those things I wasn't aware of quite what it meant. I'd heard the phrase, but it's interesting how sort of a simple thing could prevent potentially so many other problems.
Yes, very much so. They were complex things, and it's you need a fairly good engineering understanding to be able to really interpret a lot of it, and that I don't have. What I have gathered from doing the book is that a basic understanding that these men were able to put their hand to so many issues, and a lot of those issues were relative, obviously, to the engines, and they would have to make decisions to voluntarily reduce an engine's power for whatever reasons, and everything has ramifications thereafter, naturally, because of course it's the engines that carry them across to the enemy territory, and it's the engines that get them back.
Well, one of those things that they did, which I thought I'd never occurred of, if you get a hold tank, and they could see they've got a hold tank, was that rather than shut the tank off, you turn the tank on to empty it as fast as possible into the engines. And I thought, oh, that's common sense, brilliant.
Yes, because obviously, you know, your engines are consuming fairly significant quantities of fuel. And as soon as a recognition that a fuel tank, of which there were many, was likely to be problematical, then the first option is to make the best of that and to use as much of you can before its seepage is, or its escape is, you know, is elsewhere.
Yeah, brilliant. So simple. Who makes the decision when they assess the aircraft that sort of damage was catastrophic and you know, it was time to bail out? Was that a joint decision with the pilot, or is that essentially always the pilot's has the final say?
I think in circumstances where maybe a heavy bomber has sustained some significant flak, or it's survived a night fighter attack but it's been damaged, then the pilot would make an instantaneous decision if he knew quite clearly that this aircraft is totally unstable and unflyable. Then he would issue the instructions for his crew to bail out. But in normal circumstances, it would be assess the situation, use the flight engineer to assess the situation mechanically, and come up with a decision as to how they can best resolve it. And it may be that they would make a decision that to lose height would be advantageous, to lose as much weight would be advantageous, and possibly just to divert and try to make for a neutral country, or even elect within the crew whether to bail out over enemy-held territory or maybe make for the sea and ditch and chance luck that way. So these things were quite complex, and they were, I think, in the latter, they were mutual. They were, the respect for the crew was enough that it became a mutual decision.
Yeah, well, he clearly must be key to that process. My assumption is the pilot bails out last because he's got to keep the plane in the air, and so presumably the flight engineer was always second to last because presumably the two work in hand, hand to hand when they go.
Yes, there were obviously safety procedures practiced at conversion units and operationally about, ideally in circumstances, who would go where and where they would bail out. The actual survivability of crew statistics tends to indicate that the person with the greatest chance of survivability was the bomb aimer, because in effect he was just laying underneath his own personal escape hatch. That hatch would be used by other members of the cockpit, who would have to negotiate down into that point. Obviously, the crewman at the back would use the main back exit. The rear gunner had the capability to turn his turret and individually bail out from the back. And you're absolutely right. The flight engineer quite often stayed and assisted the pilot as best could he, and he would then follow the bomb aimer's exit, and then the pilot would make his decision where he's going to come out.
Before we started, I said I've been looking at some downed Halifaxes near me, and they're all Canadians. Halifaxes were flown by Canadians, but the flight engineer on the three of them was RAF and not Canadian. Now, this is down to the Commonwealth Forces not training flight engineers in great numbers.
Yes, it is. There was late in the war a facility for the Canadians to train their own flight engineers, but the norm will be that most crews will have come from Canada, they will have formed up, they will have gone through their training and conversion training, and then they would be joined by a RAF-trained flight engineer. So it is not unusual to look at manifests of crews, particularly with dedicated Canadian squadrons, to always see a British or an RAF member of their crew being the flight engineer. And that only changed right towards the end of the war.
I think it's the RAF's interesting because it's very much more of a polyglot organisation than necessarily the army, probably because of these reasons. People didn't have men, so they swapped and changed their personnel nationally about where was necessary.
Yes, I think the reason that that anomaly exists so predominantly is the evolution of the role, the design of the four-engined aircraft requiring it, and the Commonwealth training program that was already in being didn't accommodate for that role, and that's why the vast majority of flight engineers will have all gone through St. Athens complex in this country, and flight engineers' logbooks, if you're fortunate enough to ever find one, will have a large green stamped endorsement in there, and most of them are signed off with a big stamp from St. Athens, because that's where they all came from. But I'm absolutely sure that these RAF flight engineers were very much welcomed and integrated into the Canadian crews, and of course most of the flight engineers being non-commissioned officers, quite often you had a full non-commissioned officer bomber crew in a Canadian squadron, and the integration was fairly non-problematical.
So by the end of the war, there's nearly 18,000 men had qualified as flight engineers. I mean, were they ever recognised separately at the end of the war for their contribution?
No, not really. You'll be aware that the Bomber Command sort of had a little bit of stigma attached to it at the end of the war through some of the final operations, and it took quite a while really for Bomber Command itself to sort of break that, and the Bomber Command memorial statue in London did a long way to recognise the crew's entirety, and within those fantastic figures which have been cast, there is a flight engineer, and that's almost recognition in itself.
Yeah, it's a wonderful statue. I used to pass it regularly when I lived in London. That seems like a good place to finish. Thanks, Colin. If people want to find out more about the overlooked role of flight engineers, the book to read is Fuel, Fire and Fear, RAF Flight Engineers at War by Colin Pateman. That's it for now. Don't forget, if you're on Facebook, you can look me up, WW2 Podcast. I do try to post things relevant to the latest episode of the podcast. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.
And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.